It is Wednesday, December 18th, 2013, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
And I'm Christina Thomas. Ozarks at Large is underwritten in part by the Walton Family Charitable Support Foundation.
Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, the Springdale School District receives a nearly $26 million grant. The district is one of five in the nation to receive a portion of the Race to the Top grant. Plus, Arkansas State University plans to build a new campus in Mexico.
Also, we take a tour of King Opera House in Van Buren, get an update on a lawsuit filed to strike down the state's constitutional ban on same-sex marriage, and more.
But first, a Pulaski County judge yesterday dismissed a Freedom of Information lawsuit against Secretary of State Mark Martin. Attorney Matt Campbell, who runs the Democratic-leaning Blue Hog Report, filed suit seeking digital copies of documents that would show editing changes. But when he didn't have any witnesses to testify at the hearing, Judge Tim Fox ruled in favor of a defense request for dismissal. Campbell argues that doesn't make sense procedurally, saying he just wanted an opinion based on what was filed with the court.
We needed a ruling on a question of law, which is something that falls squarely for the judge, and there was no testimony available that was going to shed light one way or the other. You know, the pleadings on this were pretty voluminous, and our positions on whether the statute required disclosure were pretty well fleshed out. We just needed the judge to determine yes or no, and there was never any suggestion that witnesses were needed, by anybody prior to this.
Campbell promises this won't be the end of the matter.
I plan to file, a post-trial motion on this and, an appeal and keep it going because, the burden in a FOIA suit doesn't fall on the plaintiff anyway. The presumption is in favor of disclosure. The burden is on the defendant to show that the non-disclosure complied with the law. So, there was none of that. So I don't know that it changes anything from my perspective other than just requires more legal work on this case.
The case was related to the use of outside legal counsel by the Secretary of State's office without first consulting the Attorney General. A spokesman for Secretary of State Martin says they are pleased the issues were resolved in favor of the office and they remain committed to following the law.
A New York-based fruit and vegetable producer could acquire Siloam Springs-based Allen's Foods. According to the CityWire, Seneca Foods Corporation yesterday entered into a $148 million asset purchase agreement, a deal that would give the company essentially all of Allen's operating assets, as well as the assumption of certain liabilities. Allen's filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy relief on October 28th. The transaction would take place through a court-supervised process and is subject to an auction and bankruptcy court approval. Seneca Foods is the largest processor of canned fruits and vegetables in the country. The two companies previously attempted to merge in July 2011, but the potential deal was terminated in September of that year.
A Mountain Home manufacturer will soon add more jobs to the area's workforce. Yesterday, Epoxin Products announced plans to expand its manufacturing facility in Mountain Home, resulting in 50 additional jobs. Using the Premier Laboratory Works surface materials of epoxy and phenolic resin, the company manufactures equipment for research, educational, and healthcare laboratory environments. Epoxin is a subsidiary of Hamilton Scientific, a 132-year-old laboratory, furniture, and equipment supplier that is headquartered in Wisconsin.
The Occupational Safety and Health Administration has cited Tyson Foods for four workplace violations following a June 17th accident at the company's Hutchinson, Kansas facility. During the incident, a conveyor belt that was being cleaned at the end of a shift severed a worker's hand. The company was cited for two willful violations for failing to train workers on lockout procedures. One serious violation was cited for failing to provide fixed stairs to reach work areas on the plant's upper platform. And one citation was issued for an other-than-serious violation, which involved illegible markings on forklift levers. Tyson faces $147,000 in proposed fines for the violations. A Tyson spokesperson says that the company is reviewing the citation and will work cooperatively with OSHA to resolve any concerns.
The Vice Chancellor for University Advancement at the University of Arkansas Fort Smith has accepted a position as Executive Director of the Winthrop Rockefeller Institute in Morrilton. Marta Lloyd will begin her new position February 10th. Lloyd has worked at UAFS for 17 years and has been in the role of Vice Chancellor for 12 years. She has also been the Executive Director of the University Foundation at UAFS since 2002, transforming the West Ark Community College Foundation's $20 million in assets into a foundation with an endowment of more than $60 million and assets upwards of $75 million. The U of A system established the Winthrop Rockefeller Institute in 2005 as a conference center aimed at bringing diverse populations together to discuss ideas affecting Arkansas and the nation as a whole.
Also at the U of A, the dean of the Honors College at the Fayetteville campus has announced his retirement. Robert McMath, the first dean of the Honors College, will retire in August of next year, following 8 years in the role. According to the university, student enrollment in the Honors College has grown by 44%. Average GPA for Honors College students has risen, and the college has maintained a 90% freshman retention rate since 2005, all under McMath's leadership. Prior to coming to the U of A, McMath was a history professor and held various administrative posts at Georgia Tech over the course of 33 years. His replacement as Honors College Dean will be selected through a national search process.
The Full Circle Campus Food Pantry at the U of A in Fayetteville has received an award from the Points of Light organization. The student-run food pantry was recognized as the Daily Point of Light earlier this week. The Points of Light organization was founded in 1990 as an international nonprofit, nonpartisan organization dedicated to solving social problems through volunteerism, while the Daily Point of Light Award was created by President George H.W. Bush in 1989 as a way of recognizing ordinary Americans making direct and consequential voluntary action in their communities.
Expect partly cloudy skies this evening with overnight lows around 44 degrees. Partly sunny tomorrow, Thursday, with highs around 66. Mostly cloudy tomorrow evening with a 30% chance of rain after midnight. Lows from 50 in northwest Arkansas to 55 in the Arkansas River Valley.
This is Ozarks at Large. The Springdale School District is going to be able to put plan into action after receiving word yesterday the district had earned a nearly $26 million grant. Springdale is one of five districts in the nation to receive a portion of the $120 million Race to the Top grant, a prize the school applied for last year, too, when the district finished as a finalist. Yesterday, Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums talked to Rick Schaefer, the communications director for the district, just hours after the United States Department of Education had informed district officials of the award, when the news was still settling in.
I mean, to receive a grant like this is it's just downright overwhelming.
I know that you almost $26 million in this grant. When and how did the school district find out that they had been one of the schools selected?
Found out this morning around 10:30, and they made it public with an announcement at 1:30 today out of the United States Department of Education. This is the second year for the Race to the Top grants, and Springdale was among the finalists last year, made the first cut, didn't make the second cut. And so this is the first time a district from the state of Arkansas has actually received this grant. And it's a four-year grant. This is a five-year program, so the recipients from last year had 5 years to utilize the funds, and Springdale will have four, and is one of five districts in the entire country to get this. So, again, it's just overwhelming. And what it does is it allows you to, you know, every district has vision, and then you also have a budget. And so you can't always reach your total vision with your budget. This extra funding will allow the District of Springdale to do some things that we've been thinking about for years, and now we'll be actually able to put it into practice.
How does the process work to apply for the Race for the Top grant? What do you have to submit and do?
It's an extensive procedure, a lot of paperwork to apply. And Dr. Marcia Jones, is one of our assistant superintendents or associate superintendents. She's been here for many, many years. She spearheaded this entire process, but everybody's got to be involved. Mayor Doug Sprouse, the city of Springdale, they've got to sign that they'll be a partner. Your Chamber of Commerce has to say the business community is going to be involved. So Perry Webb, the Springdale Chamber of Commerce chair, he was right there with us all the way, too. You've got to have partnerships from within your district. You've got to have your teachers ready to go along. You've got to have parents ready to go along. That's a big part of this grant is parent involvement. So there are a lot of people involved. It's an extensive procedure. But boy, when you get that notification, it makes it all worthwhile.
This is the sort of thing that works K through 12, right?
Yes, K through 12. And of course, Springdale is the second largest district in the state of Arkansas. We have slightly more than 21,000 students when you count our pre-K kids. And so this is a grant that's going to impact a lot of lives.
You mentioned that there is vision and there is budget. I know, as you and I are talking, it's just been hours since you've notified, but what is the process now to see what part of vision can be implemented?
Well, they specifically, when you ask for the money in the grant, you do talk about how you're going to use it. And so the plan is in place, and now it's a matter of the dollars come in and you execute that plan. One of the plans that the Springdale School District has is for a school of innovation. That'll be for kids ninth grade through 12th. We may be able to start it as soon as next year. And that means they're taking classes kind of at their own pace. There'll be obviously instruction in the classroom. There can be internet instruction. It's just kind of a neat concept that, again, business leaders in our community have really helped us design this as well. There are programs for parental involvement where we can get more parents involved, particularly when you think of Springdale, our district. And I know in Northwest Arkansas, the prosperity hides some of the economic difficulties, but about 66% of our students qualify for free and reduced lunch. And sometimes, you know, you need really innovative ways to get some of those parents who are working and doing the hardest, doing everything they can to keep their kids, their families afloat, get them involved in the educational process. So that's involved here as well. One-on-one technology. You know, no matter what your budget is, it's pretty hard to afford technology for every student in your district. This grant will allow us to have one-on-one technology with every student in our district. So those are a few of the things, but they're very exciting for us.
It's impossible to measure, but what this could mean for a school district and a community years out.
You know, that is a great, great point, and that's what this is all about. And, you know, certainly we can agree or disagree with the political stances of our national leaders or even those in education, but the bottom line that education promotes is the future of the communities. And you make a very good point. There's no telling what this can mean to the city of Springdale and all of Northwest Arkansas in the next 5 to 15 years. When your kids have even a higher educational opportunity, because Springdale's always been known for excellent education, but now you go to even a higher level, you're training kids. The whole idea of Common Core is to be college and or career ready or both, and so you're accelerating that process with the community, with our business community involved. Our School of Innovation will not only award a high school degree, but also an associate's degree, which means they're going to be trained in a field to help them be ready to go right into the professional field if they wish, or take them into a college at an advanced level. So there are just all kinds of implications for our future that this has meaning in, and we're very, very excited about what it means to Springdale and really all of Northwest Arkansas.
And of course, along with this honor and this money comes that sense of responsibility that this is, you know, a sizable amount, and now the work begins, right?
The results certainly need to be there, and we're very aware of that. And I think that having experienced staff, Dr. Jim Rollins has been superintendent for this is his 32nd year. I mentioned Marcia Jones. She's been here for 20-something years. You've got an experienced staff, and you also have a young, energetic staff as administrators. Our new assistant superintendent for technology, Clay Hendricks, is a young guy and has superintendent experience. We've got a faculty, many experienced, and a lot of young energy. And so, I think everybody's ready to get on board. But the results eventually are what are going to count, and obviously we're going to work very hard to make sure the results are absolutely outstanding.
And I don't know off the top of my head, and maybe you do, maybe you don't, what the school district's budget is, but put into perspective what nearly 26 million over 4 years, what that means as opposed to the normal sort of budget life.
Our overall budget is somewhere around $130 million per year. That sounds like a lot, but you know, a lot of that, obviously, we with 21,000 students, we have 2,500 employees, 1,500 and some odd of those are certified. That means they're teachers, principals, administrators. And so, you know, that takes up a large amount of our budget. We've done a lot of construction. In Springdale, we've built 13 schools over the last 12 years. That's because the growth has just been astonishing. And so you still have some debt retirement there. I wish I could say every school's paid for. They're not. But we have a plan, obviously, and a debt plan. So that's part of your budget as well. So to when you start thinking about other projects you'd like to take on, you know, well, with the money that you have available, sometimes you can't do all those things. And that's why when you say $25 million, and again, it's going to be spread out over a period of time, but nonetheless, that is a huge investment into programs that otherwise we might not be able to do.
And finally, some of these things that you now will be able to do, perhaps in 5 or 6 years, other school districts nearby will be looking at, and they can ask for advice what worked and what didn't.
That's another great point, Kyle, because frankly, we were going to try and do this whether we got the grant or not. You have to look for other forms of revenue to do that, whether you're looking for private sources or from whatever sources you can get them from, donations, technology donations. But this plan, we were ready to go whether we got the grant or not. Obviously, this makes it makes it a lot easier to get done, and it accelerates the process. It's not something that we have to say, okay, we're going to do this year, maybe we'll get to that next year. Well, instead, the process is accelerated. But you're right, Springdale is not a selfish district. Whatever we're able to do, if it leads to higher achievement, which we believe we will, then we want to share that with everybody in the state of Arkansas and really anybody in the country. One of the things Jim Rollins enjoyed today, our superintendent, is on the conference call with the four other superintendents. There are only five districts in the entire United States that got these grants. And one of the things he talked to them about was cooperative efforts, talking with each other about what worked in your district, what maybe didn't work as well as you thought it would, and so we can help each other and therefore take what we've learned and share it with other districts.
Well, once again, congratulations, Rick, and thank you so much for your time.
You bet, Kyle. Thank you.
Rick Schaefer is the communications director for the Springdale Public School District. He talked to Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums yesterday after the district was awarded a $25.88 million grant from the United States Department of Education.
Last Thursday, a preliminary hearing was held before Pulaski County Circuit Judge Chris Piazza on a lawsuit filed last summer to strike down an Arkansas constitutional ban on same-sex marriage, approved by 74% of voters 10 years ago. Ozarks at Large's Jacqueline Froelich spoke with attorneys on both sides of the case, as well as a lead plaintiff, and brings us this story.
I am attorney representing the plaintiffs in Wright versus State of Arkansas.
On July 2nd, attorney Cheryl Maples filed a lawsuit against the state of Arkansas on behalf of lead plaintiff Kendall Wright and her spouse Julia Wright, two of 43 named individuals challenging Arkansas's ban on same-sex marriage.
We are asking that the court find that Amendment 83 that was passed in 2004 by the voters of the state of Arkansas be found unconstitutional.
The purpose of the Thursday hearing was twofold, she said.
We have filed a motion for emergency preliminary injunction asking that the married couples, for purposes of only the married couples, the court find that the state of Arkansas not be able to continue to support the laws and amendment to the Constitution while this case is pending.
A trial date has not yet been set. Maples has asked for injunctive relief, she says, to protect Arkansas same-sex couples legally married in other states. Maples filed her lawsuit a week after the U.S. Supreme Court, in hearing States versus Windsor, struck down part of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, resulting in federal recognition of legally married same-sex couples. But the ruling stopped short of declaring a U.S. constitutional right to marry, leaving it up to states to decide. 16 states and Washington, D.C. have legalized same-sex marriage so far. Three states without such a law convey spousal rights to such couples. Arkansas doesn't do either of those things. So Maples of Searcy and co-counsel Jack Wagner of Little Rock are challenging Arkansas, as well as seven county clerks, for refusing to issue marriage licenses to same-sex couple applicants. At the hearing, Faulkner County civil attorney David Hogue represented Faulkner County Clerk Melinda Reynolds.
She took an oath of office when she took this office that says that she would support the Constitution and the laws of Arkansas.
David Hogue is challenging the lawsuit, saying that marriage is a fundamental right limited in Arkansas to one man and one woman.
Because that's the only type of relationship that produces children without third-party involvement. And the state, historically, has a compelling even interest in channeling that procreation power into stable homes. And the way they do that is to give them that marriage and all the benefits that go with it.
David Hogue also argued against the plaintiff's wish to strike down Arkansas's gay marriage ban as unconstitutional, saying Amendment 83 cannot violate the Constitution that it amends. And second,
The word marriage, or even the definition of marriage, isn't in the Declaration of Rights, and there's nothing in our Arkansas Constitution or the cases that have interpreted our Arkansas Constitution that establishes the right to marry, especially, or the right to marry a member of the same sex, as a right that is declared in our Constitution.
David Hogue points to the U.S. Supreme Court's Defense of Marriage Act, reinforcing states to decide the matter.
This is a state sovereignty issue. The federal DOMA law, Defense of Marriage Act, Section 2 still stands, and that federal law specifically says that the states have the right to accept or deny marriages from other states. And there's a whole set of jurisprudence that says that marriage is definition of marriage is the prerogative of the state. The reason Windsor did what it did is because the federal government doesn't have that authority.
At the hearing, Assistant Attorney General Colin Jorgensen represented the state's two defendants, the Arkansas Department of Health, because it handles marriage records, and the Arkansas Department of Finance and Administration, which handles tax records. Jorgensen, who declined being interviewed for this report, has asked for the lawsuit to be dismissed. In a brief filed November 26th, Jorgensen wrote that the state gay marriage ban is based on the authority of the people, but attorney for the plaintiffs, Cheryl Maples, argues that the ban was passed by voters nearly 10 years ago and does not reflect current cultural consensus.
It's important that people in the minority not have their rights stripped by the majority. That's exactly what our constitutional rights are there for, and this is not something that the voters can deny to other individuals just because they're in the minority.
Leading up to the Supreme Court's DOMA ruling, a Washington Post-ABC News poll issued last March found 58% of voters nationwide support the freedom to marry, including 81% of young voters aged 18 to 30. But a newly released Arkansas poll conducted by the Diane Blair Center of Southern Politics and Society found that less than a quarter of Arkansans believe gay couples should be allowed to legally marry.
It's just, I cannot understand why this is not legal.
Jonathan Cody Reniger and his partner William Thomas Stade, two of Cheryl Maples' plaintiffs, made national news after they submitted a wedding announcement to the Northwest Arkansas Times in early 2012, which was rejected.
Tried to put our engagement picture in the newspaper, and they told us that they wouldn't do that because that was the way they'd always done it, and it wasn't legal in the state.
Reniger said due to a flurry of national protests, he was contacted by 50 newspapers who told him they had changed policies about publishing same-sex wedding notices. Reniger and Stade represent a diverse group of LGBTQ Arkansans who've elected to be included in the equal marriage lawsuit. The couple, who have a child, formally committed to each other at a home wedding ceremony in Arkansas, but have refused to legally marry outside of the state.
Us personally, we're not going to do that until it's legal in our own state, because this is where we live. This is our home. This is where we were born and raised.
Cody Reniger was not at the hearing, but kept close tabs on the proceedings via other plaintiffs and social networks.
It seemed unarguable. It just seemed so black and white.
Black and white? In this case, the right of marriage between blacks and whites, known as Loving versus Virginia, was cited in the lawsuit as reason to strike down the Arkansas gay marriage ban. In the landmark 1967 U.S. Supreme Court case, the justices ruled that state bans on interracial marriage were unconstitutional. And Cheryl Maples argues that in the Loving case, the U.S. Supreme Court recognized marriage to be a basic civil right, fundamental to our very existence and survival. And for the record, 4 years ago, Judge Chris Piazza, after a 10-year battle, struck down an adoption ban limited to only married couples and single individuals, opening the door for same-sex couples to adopt. Pending Judge Piazza's ruling and a hoped-for trial, Cheryl Maples anticipates appealing this historic marriage equality case to the Arkansas Supreme Court. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Jacqueline Froelich.
It is Wednesday, December 18th, 2013. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Thomas.
Hi, I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
With us now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor with Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Okay, I'm through panicking.
Okay.
Good.
And I'm thinking about road trips.
Where are we going?
Well, if we could get to St. Louis tonight, we could see the Donnie and Marie Christmas tour.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
It's at the Scott Trade Center tonight. Or if we could get to Dallas and Fort Worth this weekend, we could see the Irving Berlin White Christmas production at the Music Hall at Fair Park.
In case we missed it here.
Exactly. In Little Rock on the 20th, the Trans-Siberian Orchestra is at Verizon Arena.
Always comes through.
And in Tulsa, something completely different.
Okay.
On December 30th, Cheech and Chong with the band War.
Really?
Okay.
At the Hard Rock Hotel.
I might have to check that out. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
that's hilarious.
That would be something unlike anything you've done before.
I like that.
That's funny.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers. Arkansas State University is scheduled to break ground on a new campus in Querétaro, Mexico, in February. ASU will be the first American university to bring an American-style education system to the Mexican state of Querétaro. Jonathan Reeves from our content partner KASU in Jonesboro has more.
After years of collaboration and planning between officials in Mexico and Arkansas State University, groundbreaking ceremonies on the first phase of the massive project are now less than 2 months away. Members of Mexico's delegation made a presentation to faculty and staff recently at Arkansas State University in Jonesboro to show what the new campus will look like, as well as what the new campus will mean to the citizens in the progressive Mexican state of Querétaro. Edmundo Ortiz is with the Association for Advancement of Higher Education in Mexico, and he explains what the new campus will mean to Mexico.
It's the first American-style university campus in Mexico. So the first impact is arriving in an American-style university with dorms and with the same title will be valid in two countries. We are impacting the very, very deep system, because we will provide the opportunity to people study in Mexico or work in the United States, for example. We are also providing the opportunity that people that are studying here work directly in Mexico, because we'd be valid for both countries, the title.
The Mexican state of Querétaro is located in the middle of the country and is home to about 1.9 million people. The state is deemed to be very progressive and that hundreds of companies have located to the area. Ortiz explains.
In Querétaro, there are 850 different industries, multinational, aerospace sector, automotive sector, electrodomestic sector, and food, biotechnology, and business in general. We have the opportunity to grow a new relationship between the university and the industry, making more research, impacting in the future, and making new relations with trust, because you already have the trust from the industry as a university here. You already have the connections. So a lot of industry that have you here is over there too. So they are happy to have the same university in the state. So the relation and the growth of the technology inside the university helping the industry, it will be an incredible opportunity.
The new campus of Arkansas State University will be built just outside of Querétaro City and is being built in four phases to the tune of about $15 million per phase. The total project is worth about $60 million, and according to Ortiz, many businesses and other donors saw the need to bring in the campus to help in the continued growth of the region.
We are providing, as you see in the master plan, a special place to increase the speed and the growth of Querétaro for a specific direction, appointed to some specific address. And we are helping, and we are glad that with the help of Arkansas State University over there, we will develop one zone, employment in a social way. We also think it will be marvelous to have the mix inside the university, the mix of people that can afford the tuition and people that will be invited for scholarships to study there, given the opportunity to develop his lives. So the impact is in so many ways always positive, but in so many ways.
Groundbreaking of the new campus is scheduled for February 5th. The master plan calls for the new campus to be located near the Querétaro Airport, just outside of Querétaro City. A road will be built to link the new campus with the city. The new campus is actually a complex that will also include commercial property for shopping and eating. On both sides of the campus are residential areas for students to live in while attending class, and sports fields and complexes will be located on either end of the campus. Sports will include basketball, tennis, American-style football, soccer, baseball, and more. The new campus will have a lot of the features and amenities the Jonesboro campus has. By way of the number of acres, ASU's Querétaro campus will cover 256 acres. The academic and sports areas will cover 173 acres, and the residential, commercial, and mixed use will cover 123 acres. The first phase will be complete by the fall of 2015, as 5,000 students will go to class. When all four phases are done, the student capacity is expected to be about 20,000 students. The first phase will have 4,300 student residences and 76 apartments for faculty. The town center will have commercial space for shopping, restaurants, coffee shops, and a hotel. In the first phase, there will be 30 classrooms that will hold 25 to 30 students each, 8 larger classrooms, 3 lecture halls, 3 biology, physical sciences, and chemistry labs, 4 mechanical engineering labs, 4 electrical engineering labs, and 5 multiple-use labs. The first phase will also include the building of the student union, which will have a lobby, dining hall, and food court, retail area, lounge, boardroom, a large meeting room for up to 600 attendees, and administrative offices will also be located at the student union. Recreational areas will also consist on the first phase. There will be fitness rooms, multipurpose rooms, equipment rooms, and more. The Academic Resources Center will include faculty offices, graduate assistant offices, the main library area, and numerous computer labs. There will even be an events plaza and facilities management also in the first phase. The second phase will start in 2016 and will include building the sports complexes and fields. The third phase will start in 2018 and will consist of the main town center and retail areas. and the fourth phase will start in 2021 and will include building the rest of the project. In a recent interview, Jonesboro Chancellor of Arkansas State University, Dr. Tim Hudson, said the new campus will benefit Arkansas as much as it will benefit Mexico.
One of the things that I always say is we have a mission for globalization at this institution. We just went through an accrediting process where we promised to our students and our accreditors that we will provide our students global experiences. So this campus will, without any question, facilitate the mobility of students, the mobility of faculty. It'll lead to collaborative research. There's not a week goes by that we don't receive a resume, a research project, an idea from someone either in Mexico who works in Mexico about potential collaboration with our faculty. So there's going to be a lot of opportunity for student mobility, faculty mobility, staff mobility. At the same time, we're going to have access to over 800 multinational corporations who can provide internships for our own students as well as the students in Mexico. And in the final analysis, it's good business. Mexico, by some ranks, is the 14th or 15th largest economy in the world. Their affluence is growing. The number of students who are seeking higher education is growing. The demand is there. So we have a product, if you will, that is in high demand in Mexico, and we need to be able to deliver that product to be competitive in the global market. And we will garner resources. We will make some money that we can use to support the core operations here on the campus.
Dr. Hudson says a vision for the campus was something that's been collaborative from the start.
This is a collective vision. I have to give credit to my partners in Mexico who helped brainstorm this entire idea. In fact, I like the way Edmundo Ortiz, our partner in Mexico, describes this. He says it's assembling a dream. And to assemble this dream, we need partners who bring to the table the thing that they do best. And what we do best is deliver an academic curriculum. The third thing is we are really in the business here of transforming the trajectory of higher education in Mexico. There are people in Mexico who understand that the next generation of Mexican leaders need to be trained and educated to be global citizens. They are seeking a meritocracy. Much of the world views America as the greatest experiment in merit-based socioeconomic progress. We are who we are because of our ability and our achievements, not necessarily what our last name is. Now, we know it's not perfect. So Mexicans look at us, and I think much of the world looks at the United States and says, how do you achieve such a functioning democracy, even with all of its warts, and such a meritocracy? And one of the answers is we have the best higher education system in the world. So that part of this dream is very fulfilling from my point of view.
And that's Dr. Tim Hudson, who says the dream to put an Arkansas State University campus in Mexico will become reality with the groundbreaking that will take place in the first phase on February 5th. In Jonesboro, I'm Jonathan Reeves reporting.
This is Ozarks at Large. The state's Agriculture Department has organized an Arkansas Festival grant program. The department will administer $45,000 in one-time funding made available to the Arkansas Livestock and Poultry Commission for Arkansas festivals featuring an agricultural or forestry product, commerce, or theme. Zachary Taylor, Director of Marketing for the Arkansas Agriculture Department, says the money for the program has been funded by the state legislature. Earlier this week, I reached Taylor by phone in his Little Rock office to learn more about the grant program.
Here in Arkansas, we have a number of festivals, everything from the Bradley Pink Tomato Festival to the Hope Watermelon Festival. You know, there's a rice festival in there. There's a catfish festival. And, you know, it was felt that these festivals are important to the quality of life and the economy in cities and towns across the state. And so that's why we as the Arkansas Agriculture Department was asked to facilitate this grant.
And who all is eligible to apply for the grant? You guys have a total of $45,000 to give out to people in different increments.
Who is eligible for this is the a fiscal agent of a county or city government. And the way that works is the fiscal agent being the mayor and city council or the county judge and quorum court, fills out the application, sends it in to us. A lot of what we're seeing is the management for these festivals within these towns and cities and counties, they're taking it to their city and county fiscal agents, and filling it out, getting them to sign off of it, and then sending it in to us.
I noticed on your website, one of the things that you ask is that the festival is an annual one, and it can be one that exists or one that will exist. So are you hoping to receive applications from folks trying to start new festivals?
We are. This is one-time money. And so, we hope that even though it is only one-time money, that this might, light a spark somewhere that could bring new festivals to the state of Arkansas.
Why is it important to have these new festivals? Have you seen a decline in these types of festivals in the years as, say, things have become perhaps less rural in some parts of the state?
And I really can't name off the top of my head any that have disappeared. In some places, their turnout in the years past haven't been as great as they were in decades past, but really kind of across the board, a lot of your festivals, especially like in Northwest Arkansas, have kept going on over the years.
Well, the agricultural industry is the state's largest industry, and it provides more than $17 billion to the economy. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And
1 in 6 jobs.
So with these festivals, does it help promote the ag? Is that the idea, is to help promote the agricultural economy here in the state?
It is. Nowadays, most people, even here in Arkansas, are either third or fourth generation removed from the farm. And if you go out on the streets, be it here in Little Rock or even the streets in Fayetteville or Jonesboro or Pine Bluff or anywhere, you'll run into a majority of people that don't realize how big agriculture is in the state of Arkansas. The overall economy here in Arkansas is about $100 billion economic impact. Agriculture is a $17 billion economic impact, so 17% of our state's economy is agriculture. And I think these festivals do a really good point of pointing out to people that, agriculture is really still rooted pretty deep in Arkansas's economy.
Now, we've talked about perhaps people wanting to start a new festival and how this money could help them. How can this help somebody who already has a festival up and running? Have some of those been suffering monetarily?
A lot of programs across the state have suffered due to the downturn in the economy that happened a couple years ago. Talking to a lot of these managers of these festivals, it hasn't put any out of business, but with the downturn in the economy that most people experienced, they have seen their budgets limited. And the one nice thing about the money that we're offering is, we offer up to a maximum of $5,000. And, something like that for some festivals, that might cover, half of their festival. For other festivals, that might cover an event that they have at that festival. And a real good example of our money being able to cover an event is there's a steak cook-off here in Arkansas, and they have a competition the night before. That's an eating competition. And in that competition, they purchase a large amount of beef that's very costly. And so, our fund, if that festival applies for it and is granted those funds, they'll offset that cost. And so it just takes some of the risk off of them. Because on some of these festivals are done nonprofitly, where in others of these festivals around the state are funded by their quorum courts and their city councils.
From your standpoint at the Arkansas Agriculture Department, why is it important to have things like these festivals in order to educate Arkansas residents about the importance of agriculture in the state? Because like you said, lots of folks are several generations removed from the farm.
Well, I think it's important to have these festivals and educate Arkansans on the importance of agriculture in the state, because going back to what I said earlier, agriculture is a $17 billion economic impact in the state. And, agriculture has been important in our state economy since before the founding of the state in the 1830s. And one great thing about Arkansas is that we are centrally located here in the U.S. In the Mississippi River Delta, so we're in just the superb place for agriculture. And I think it's important for Arkansans to know that, because not only are they being fed by the agriculture sector, but we're feeding the world. And when you look at our three major companies here in the state, in Northwest Arkansas, all three of those are involved in and got their start in by agriculture in some form. And so, you know, that's what I think makes those festivals important, is that people understand that heritage and understand that that's a driver of the Arkansas economy.
Zachary Taylor is the director of marketing for the Arkansas Agriculture Department. We spoke by phone earlier this week. Applicants for the grant program may apply for a minimum of $1,000 and up to a maximum of $5,000. Grant funds may be used for operating and program expenses and must be spent within 1 year. Applications must be received by 4:30 p.m. January 24th of 2014. More information is available at aad.arkansas.gov.
Imagine that it is the dawn of the 20th century, and a new opera house has just opened on Main Street in downtown Van Buren. Picture ladies decked out in Victorian dresses, and men don suits and top hats as they walk into the grand glass and wooden doors and past the box office to sit in wooden seats for the opening night of Faust inside King Opera House. Van Buren had a theater in the 1800s. However, it burned to the ground in 1889. H.B. King, a local businessman, saw the need for a cultural center such as an opera house and purchased this commercial building at 427 Main Street in 1898. According to current house manager Janice Ross, King was first and foremost a businessman, leaving the businesses that existed inside the building open.
In 1901, when the opera house opened, on one side you had a pool hall, and on the other side you had a saloon. So then you came into the middle and came back through and into the opera house.
October 18th, 1901, brought in the Lambroni Brothers Production Company and that first production of Faust, which Ross says was an interesting choice for the audience of the area.
And the consensus was that they didn't really feel like maybe it was what they, you know, it had been promised to be. And I'm thinking, Faust.
Over the next 9 or so years, King chose many a vaudeville show to perform on the stage of his opera house, in addition to circuses and town hall meetings. As it was before the days of the Travel or Discovery Channel, speakers or residents lucky enough to travel would show slideshows of their adventures, transporting Van Bureners to New York, Virginia, and as far away as Europe. Around 1910 came the advent of the silent picture, and thus the end of vaudeville. King sold the opera house in 1914.
It said in the paper that it would be remodeled and it would become Van Buren's first moving picture house. And it was that until, well, the Malco chain bought it in the 1960s. So it was I lived in Fort Smith in the 60s, and my children were, you know, grade school age, and I would bring them over here on Saturdays to see Disney movies, and by then that's kind of what it was.
The city of Van Buren purchased the building from Malco in 1979. The company hadn't really taken care of the building, and it was in various stages of disrepair. The city boarded it up as they decided what they wanted to do with it. The Women's League of Van Buren, along with other area local organizations, applied for grants and held other efforts to raise funds to renovate the opera house. The city hired an architect to take on the challenge of turning the auditorium into a turn-of-the-century opera house. To qualify as such with the National Register of Historic Places, the renovation had to include a horseshoe balcony and box seats. The dark wood and green paint replacing the wallpaper audiences and performers saw on opening night in 1901.
Now we're standing on the stage, and what you see looking back, none of this was here. They stripped everything back. There's a picture made in the early 1980s. Bill Clinton was still governor, and he's standing out in the middle of the auditorium there. There's on dirt, everything was gone, and you can just see the studs, the original timbers.
Ross believes that the attached seats and slanted floor of today were also added on based on newspaper accounts she's read.
One of the articles in the old newspapers talks about along like in July or so of 1901 of Mr. King ordering the latest style in bentwood chairs. Now, one account I've read that they were folding chairs. I don't think the floor would have been slanted like it is now, because there's one mention of where one of the fraternal organizations had their annual ball here, and that supper was served on stage at 9 p.m., and then the chairs were moved back to allow for dancing.
The renovation work was completed by members of the Western Arkansas Employment Development Agency, or WAEDA, a federally funded nonprofit organization which operates under the Workforce Investment Act in order to help increase the employability of area residents. One former worker recalled his experience of digging out the basement for the theater's green room and dressing rooms as he toured the building recently with Ross.
So we come through and we get to right here, and going just to the top of the last steps going down into the green room. And he said, all right here's where I worked. He said, I worked with a jackhammer. He said, this was all solid rock in here. And said, right here to make this stairway, he said, that's what I did. I worked with a jackhammer. I did this. And then he turned to me and he said, what did they ever do about the bones that we found here?
Ross has since asked around, but nobody knows anything about that. As we walk from the set of stairs connecting the stage with the green room, across that room to another set of stairs that lead up to the orchestra pit, Ross explains that there have indeed been rumors and stories that King Opera House is haunted. Many accounts include an apparition of a young man dressed in a Victorian-era suit and top hat. It is said that this is the ghost of a young actor, Charles Tillman, who was killed at the Van Buren train depot by a prominent doctor in town. As the story goes, Tillman was a touring actor who was set to leave for his next production. While in Van Buren, Tillman had fallen in love with the young daughter of that doctor, and the two were set to elope the day the father walked into the train station and shot the actor. Rosh recounts the interesting account of a recent audience member as the house lights dimmed and the stage lights went up.
She said the seat beside of her, which, as you see, generally, if you pull it down, it goes back up. The seat beside of her went down. She said, just as if someone were actually sitting in it. So she just thought, oh, well, just, I guess it's just a weird thing that happened. So her attention goes to the stage, and then right before intermission, right before the lights come up in the auditorium, the seat comes back up.
She says there are many unexplained incidents that occur inside the opera house. And as for Ross's own encounters with the ghost.
What I find now, I come in so many times, and the one I find is the light in the men's restroom downstairs is on a lot. I've had the light up there. I hear about 2 years ago, I was in the building by myself, and I had gone up in the light booth, the light switch is at the bottom of a little stairs, and so I'd flipped it on and went up and then into the light booth, and I'm in there turning some lights on the stage because we had some people coming in a little while, and all of a sudden I hear a click and then the light goes out.
Again, she was in the building by herself. In 1998, the city created a 5-person commission, the Van Buren Municipal Auditorium Commission, to manage the property as a rental facility. Janice Ross is a member and is King Opera House's only paid employee, performing tasks from cleaning bathrooms, greeting guests, to booking events. Though they have many requests for weddings and such, they do not host private events. They do mostly concerts, pageants, fundraisers, speakers, and meetings. Just this past weekend, the stage held a performance of A Christmas Carol. And as she is a history buff and actress herself, Ross also performs in a story of the King Opera House's history. This is Ozarks at Large.
I'm Robin Young. Next time on Here and Now, the holidays are here. Perfect time to catch up on life, talk about the end of life. A new movement even suggests death dinners.
90% of Americans know that it's important to have these conversations, but only 30% have had them.
The Conversation Project, next time on Here and Now, from NPR and WBUR Boston.
Here and Now, coming up next here on KUAF 91.3 FM. Ozarks at Large is sponsored in part by the University of Arkansas Women's Giving Circle, whose mission is to transform and expand women's giving to university programs through a collective voice.
And this is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Bentonville, Greenland.
I like it. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
I'm Christina Thomas.
Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Christina will be back alongside her co-host, Kyle Kellums, and a couple of stories to tell us about.
Yes, yes. Every Thursday night, a group of local knitters gets together and knits. And so I went and visited and kind of learned about a new style of knitting called arm knitting.
Cool.
So we'll learn about that on tomorrow's edition of Ozarks at Large.
Well, I look forward to that. And again, that new edition is tomorrow at noon. Thanks again to everyone for listening, and I hope you have a fantastic Wednesday.
Yes.